Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOMLP Chapel Hill in Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research, development, and innovation. You can email us at radioinvivo@earthlink.net, and you can access a full archive of our hundreds of past programs over the past 10 years at radioinvivo.net. The Burroughs Welcome Fund is a Golden Voices underwriter here on WCOM and Radio In Vivo. The Burroughs Welcome Fund supports excellence in science education across North Carolina. The fund believes that providing students with engaging and interactive curriculum helps to spark curiosity for careers in science, mathematics, and technology. You can learn about education grant opportunities for North Carolina schools and teachers at www.bwfund.org. Radio In Vivo is proud to acknowledge the underwriting support of our friend, Mr. Steve Brockman. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by Steve for the advancement of science and education. It's also a great pleasure to acknowledge the underwriting support of Dr. Bob Conder of Carolina Neuropsychological Service in Raleigh and Chapel Hill. Bob provides neurocognitive evaluations and neurofeedback for sports concussions and optimal sports performance. You can learn more about Carolina Neuropsychological Service at carolinacns.com. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by Chapel Hill Eye Care, located at 235 South Elliott Road in Chapel Hill. Chapel Hill Eye Care provides comprehensive eye care to people of all ages. Healthy eyes for a lifetime. Chapel Hill Eye Care, 919-968-4774. And last but not least, Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the Triangle Center for Evolutionary Medicine, or TRISEM, a nonprofit center exploring the intersection of evolutionary science and medicine. TRISEM is jointly operated by Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, North Carolina State University, and North Carolina Central University. TRISEM is an incubator that promotes innovative developments in the theory and practice of evolutionary medicine by fostering cross-disciplinary collaborations among Triangle-based scholars, physicians, public health workers, and more. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank this terrific group of underwriters for their support. Genetically modified agricultural crops have been a topic of major controversy for many years, ever since scientists gained the ability to modify plants through manipulating their genes, as opposed to traditional plant breeding methods. The science around GMOs is evolving, and the questions and issues about the practice are becoming increasingly complex. Recently, the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine weighed in by releasing a landmark report called Genetically Engineered Crops, Experiences and Prospects. The 420-page publication was the product of a 20-member committee of scientific experts in the field after 2 years of intensive work. That committee was chaired by my guest on the program today. Dr. Fred Gould is William Niels Reynolds Professor of Agriculture and a distinguished university professor in the entomology department at North Carolina State University. He is also co-director of the Genetic Engineering and Society Center, a genetic engineering think tank at NC State. Among many awards, he has received the Omax Gardner Award to the UNC system faculty member with the greatest contribution to human welfare. He was elected to the National Academy of Sciences in 2011. Fred received his BS in biology at Queens College in New York City in 1971 and his PhD in ecology and evolutionary biology from the State University of New York at Stony Brook in 1977. He has been a member of the NC State faculty since 1979. Fred Gould, welcome to Radio In Vivo.
Thank you.
Let's start out, Fred, by going over this important NAS report on genetically engineered crops, as there is obviously much to discuss about it. First of all, would you give us a bit more of a thumbnail sketch of the project? I mentioned that it was 420 pages long and 20 academicians worked on the committee. What else can you tell us about it?
Yeah, well, let me start by saying that there's a history here, that the National Academy of Sciences has been very involved in looking at genetic engineering over the years and has published a number of reports on these going back to 1987 and even before then. But things have changed. Things have changed in terms of what crops are out there, what other kinds of organisms are already being commercialized. But actually, the science and technology of genetic engineering has also changed over those years. And actually, the regulatory framework that was developed to be ready for these crops started in 1986. The technology has really changed.
Sure.
And so have the products. And so the National Academy thought, okay, it's time to go back to this and do a comprehensive report. They've done reports over the years about pieces, about genetic engineering in agriculture and other things, but this was to be more comprehensive. And one of the ideas, and that's the title, is Experiences and Prospects. So it's been now 20 years since the first genetically engineered crops were commercialized.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have quite a bit of experience in some ways, and I'll talk about that. But and then other sense, we're also looking towards the future with the new technologies. And so it was an issue of looking at what's possible. So thumbnail sketch is to say that one of the things that comes out of this report is genetic engineering today is not your grandmother's genetic engineering of 1996. You know, mm-hmm. things are changing, and we have to be aware of that. So the concerns have changed, and so have the kind of product. So we wanted to get into that. And the other piece, just to emphasize, is that a lot of people wanted us to say, is genetically engineered crops good or bad? Please give the public an answer.
Right.
And of course, we would have loved to have done that, but you know, we spent a lot of time on this, and the answer is no, sorry, we wish we could give you this, but there's not just one answer to that. Not all genetically engineered crops are the same. There are some genetically engineered crops that we sort of felt could have negative ramifications if they were developed, and we see others that could be very beneficial to society. So to lump them all together and say, as a group, they're either good or bad does not really make much sense.
I see. Yeah. Well, just to get some of the nuts and bolts out there also, you had witnesses from 80 witnesses provided testimony, 700 public comments,
right,
and you examined 71,000 studies. Not personally, I'm sure. But it was a comprehensive, we call systematic review, I'm sure. Yeah. Of two decades of scientific literature. So I take it a meta-analysis is part of the mix. When was the report published?
So the report came out in May of 2016.
Right.
But to go back to what you said, yes, we heard from a lot of different people. You know, there were 20 people on our committee, mostly academics, but we also had some lawyers and other people, but mostly that was it. But we needed to bring in other expertise. And one thing that our committee recognized right off the bat is, of course, this is a very controversial subject, and there are a lot of people who have real concerns. So when we had our first public meeting, we started by inviting in groups and individuals who have been most vocal in being critical of genetically engineered crops to hear just what their concerns were. You know, there was a great 1996 National Academy report on risk assessment in a democratic society, and pointed out this thing that should be pretty obvious. You could do a great technical assessment of risk and get the right answers to the wrong questions and help nobody.
Sure.
So we wanted to make sure we talked to the people who were critical and concerned and see what their concerns were, and then take those claims and concerns and investigate them and look for the evidence. The same thing from the pro-biotechnology people. Look at their claims of how this was going to feed the world and other things. Go back and see what the real evidence was.
I see. Well, you know, it's laudable that you really did consider all different viewpoints. And I'm sure for the credibility of what came out the other end, that was critical.
Yeah.
So how did you deal with issues of potential conflict?
Oh, conflict of interest. Yes. It's, I mean, that's a real important thing. I mean, you know, from my perspective, actually working at North Carolina State University in the Genetic Engineering and Society Center with a lot of people who are steeped in, you know, social sciences and humanities, looking at these things, I really gained an appreciation for these issues of credibility, trust, and how just critically important that is. And I think conflict of interest is one of those things that can ruin credibility.
Sure.
Now, the National Academy has a policy, you know, when you start out, everybody has to put down what their financial potential conflicts are and all those things.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it actually does go beyond that. There is no one, I don't think, who is free of bias and some kind of conflict of interest. We all come to things with our own perspectives. And I can say, it's no surprise that our committee members came with a lot of different perspectives.
Sure.
And some of them have created transgenic crops. So, you know, you could say, well, they have an interest in seeing these things through. Well, others were also very much writing about genetic engineering and some of the potential conflicts in terms of consolidation of agriculture and other things. So I felt like we had a balance. Not everybody would agree, but that was something we tried to do. But you can never have one report that doesn't potentially have some bias. And actually, we were concerned about that, so concerned because of the controversial nature of this,
right,
was to sort of say, okay, maybe you trust us given all these things that we have done. But if you don't, what we're going to do is do something different than the usual National Academy process, which is to not only publish a book, but to put everything up on the website. So all of those 80 presentations that we heard, you can listen to. They're all up there to look at. And also, when we did the final product, we had these 700 comments we got from the public, sent them in, and we condensed them all to, you know, a set of questions and concerns. And you can go to that website, look at all of those concerns that were given to us, click on those, and go to the part of the report that addresses that concern. So just don't take our word for it. Mm-hmm. Look at what evidence we use to back up this and what our reasoning was. We also recognize that some people wouldn't trust any kind of a report or study that was done by industry. Some people wouldn't trust a report done by an NGO, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, NGOs are also going to have their conflict if that's where they're getting their support from, people who don't want to see genetically engineered organisms. And so everybody has that. So, but what we tried to do was for the chapters that were on the experience, both, you know, so there were three chapters, one on agronomic and ecological implications, one on the health impacts, and one on socioeconomics. There were about 900 references in that. And for each one of those, we give the affiliation of the first author, as well as, if we could find it, the funding source, so that that's available. We don't have all the authors listed. We'd love to get to that. But at least somebody can read, you know, click on something, go to our reasoning, and see what the reference is, and dismiss the ones that they don't trust, and make sure that they do hold on to the ones they do. Actually, a lot of the studies were done by the European Food Safety Association, which is really interesting. I mean, you see how careful the Europeans are about these crops. So maybe that would be a trustworthy source, and you can see where we've quoted them.
I see. So it was a bottom line, it was a very transparent process.
We hope so. We think so. We tried. you know, you can never be perfectly transparent, but right. Boy, we really tried.
So how much of your time, Fred, was taken up by chairing this committee over the last 2 years?
Yeah. Well, it took more time than I expected. And actually, I don't think you could talk to anybody on the committee who would say that when they signed up, they knew what they were getting into.
Indeed.
A nice thing about the report was, I think when we started out, nobody knew how it was going to come out. You know, because we had to really look at the literature. And one of the things I've said to other people is, one sort of implicit thing in our committee was, you could have any opinion you wanted, you could push something out, but the next meeting, you had to come back with the evidence. You know, if we didn't have evidence, we wouldn't put it in the report. So it took people a lot of time to go home and do that, and for me too.
Yeah. Absolutely. I can imagine. Well, I'd like to go over some of the many significant aspects of the reaction to the report. Yeah. But first, would you give us a quick synopsis of the major takeaway messages that the report imparts?
Well, it's interesting. So I think it's useful to go back to what happened in terms of the media coverage of this. And you could see that the New York Times and others, you know, say, you know, new National Academy report says that the current genetically engineered crops are safe to eat.
Right.
And that is one of the findings, and I'd love to go into how we came to that.
Let's do that.
Okay.
Because that's very interesting.
Yeah, because that was a major thing.
Process.
But we were concerned when we had our own press release, we didn't put that in the headline.
Right.
You know, our headline was about the fact that the bridge, the difference between current genetically engineered crops and conventionally engineered crops is getting blurred because the technology in both areas is changing so much.
Sure.
And this is something that, you know, again, people are back in 1996, and I understand this, you know, when I think about my cell phone, I have no idea how it works, but okay. You know, so, and actually, that comes back to an analogy. In 1996, you know, if you had a phone that you used, a cell phone, a dumb cell phone, and you had your laptop computer, they did completely different things.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you think about your cell phone and a laptop, some, you know, people don't even have both of them because they have integrated and do somewhat the same thing. In 1996, when what are called transgenic crops came out, they were completely different from a conventionally bred crop. Today, it's sort of like that kind of thing I said about the cell phone and the laptop. It's a little bit hard sometimes to see what you can do with genetic engineering and what you can do now with conventional breeding accompanied with genomics. So that was a major thing in our report, is to say, wait, you know, where is this line, or is there a line, and what does that say? And so where we came to was that we really have to concentrate on the characteristics of the crop itself, not how it was made.
Sure.
And that also, a thing that came as we were moving into the final part of the report, was recognition that not only had genetic engineering changed, but genetics has changed. So with all this high throughput genetics, you know, the whole human genome project has moved into plants. So we have the genomes of these plants, and now we have high throughput technology that can characterize, almost fingerprint a plant in terms of what its characteristics are. So in the past, in 1996, when they were coming out, people were saying, oh, but you might have had some kind of unintended impact on the characteristics that we can't pick up. Today, it's kind of hard to argue that you wouldn't be able to see just about everything about that crop. So we emphasized in our report that we have these new omics techniques, as they're called, high throughput screening, mm-hmm. that can really characterize a plant. And we need to move forward with those kind of things because, as I said, conventional breeding can now change crops in major ways that could lead to problems too. So why not look at all of them in this way? And of course, when we said that, of course, the industry and other people said, whoa, more regulation. But actually, we came up, we had great molecular biologists in our group and great lawyers.
Yeah.
And we came
That's
up with a way of doing a tiered review.
Sure.
So that you don't have to go through the whole process all the time. And actually, we think it can make the whole thing more streamlined. But we have to leave it up to the regulatory agencies to decide how they want to do that.
Indeed. And we will get deeper into that in a little bit. But so really the bottom line was an emphasis on product versus process.
Yes. Yeah.
Elaborate on that for me a little
Well,
bit.
So this is a lot to elaborate on. It's a little complex kind of thing, is that in the U.S., when we came up with the regulatory scheme, the goal was sort of to use it to look at the product. But then when you look at how the regulations came about, they were just looking at genetically engineered crops based on certain processes and characteristics that would capture them and not others. So the trigger to do the analysis was on the process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could mince words and come up with ways of calling it product, but it really was the process. And most other countries in the EU, it's also very much process-based. The Canadian system has changed to using the term novelty. So if you have a novel characteristic in your crop, then you look at it. And that's the system in the world that's the closest to using the product, just looking at that product, seeing what its characteristics are. You can make a crop herbicide resistant using genetic engineering. You can do the same thing using conventional approaches. Mm-hmm. If you make it, you have a crop that's herbicide tolerant to a new herbicide, it's the same thing. Why would you regulate one and not regulate the other? Why wouldn't you look at it? And that's sort of where we were going with that.
I see. Well, it's certainly, some of these questions are so very complex. I can see why it took 2 years to wade through everything and come out with you know, some definitive statements on the other end.
And one of our challenges, of course, is to get across this information to the public. Mm-hmm. You know, and the public's smart. You know, they put their time into things that really matter to them. They want, you know, to be able to digest this. So one of our challenges and stuff that we're going to do, including being on this radio show, is to sort of talk to people and make sure that we can explain ourselves. So if we can't explain ourselves, we're in trouble.
Indeed. Yeah. Well, it's been really interesting to see the communication process related to the report since its release. On its publication, the New York Times article, which you mentioned, had the headline, and I quote, "Genetically engineered crops appear to be safe to eat and do not harm the environment." Now, to me, that's kind of an ironic headline given the contents of the report, because the intent of the Academy was much more nuanced than a blanket statement like that, even though that's what people seem to want. You wrote in the preface to the report, and I quote, "We received impassioned requests to give the public a simple, general, authoritative answer about GE crops. Given the complexity of GE issues, we did not see that as appropriate." So given the headlines, it kind of looks like the press went ahead and did that anyway. Did you anticipate that that would happen?
Well, we did, and of course, that's why our own press release didn't have that in the headline.
Right.
But it's not so bad. I mean, indeed, so I think it's useful to go back to that part of the issue, is the impact of current genetically engineered crops. We're not talking about things that may be coming along, mm-hmm. but the current ones. And actually, one of the things that people sometimes don't realize is there aren't very many genetically engineered crops.
Really?
I mean, most of the acreage, you know, when you hear about that, it's huge acreage. 15%, I think, of the land is genetically engineered crops. Almost all of that is corn, soybean, and cotton.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Now, cotton is not a crop that people generally think of as being a food crop, though there are certain things in cotton that people eat. They may not know it in their ice cream and other things like that. But corn and soybean, of course, are mostly used for cattle feed, but people eat that as well. So we did take a very careful look at the data on that. And there are so many studies that have been done going over that. And some of them have come out with conclusions that there are negative impacts. We looked at all of these studies together. We looked at the experimental designs. You know, we didn't want to take for granted other people who had already reviewed it. We went back to those studies, looked at the, you know, analysis. And I guess I can give you our kind of approach that we did.
Sure.
You know, a lot of people, there are animal studies that are done. You take mice or rats and you feed this to them and you see if there are any impacts. There's been most of the studies of that sort find no effect. But what we found was that the statistical power of those tests is actually pretty low.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you don't use that many mice or rats. So could you detect a small effect? And we go into the details of that. But in the same way, in the European Union, you know, there's a concern of using too many, right, because of animal rights and other things. So those tests are circumscribed. So we took a look at those, and we looked at a study especially by a fellow named Seralini in France that found major effects in terms of tumors and stuff. And we found that underpowered as well, that those weren't conclusive studies. So we took them all together. There's a huge number of those. And all together, we didn't see anything that came out of the whole grouping of studies. But we didn't make our conclusion just based on that. We went down to look at three other kinds of evidence. One of them was just looking at compositional analysis, you know, in the 60 types of compositional components that the FDA looks at. Did we see anything that stood out And in the current crops, the cotton, the corn, you know, and the soybean, no, we didn't really see anything like that. And then we went, but of course there could be other things, and we can talk about how the high throughput gets that. You only looked at 60 things. There could be a lot of other things going on. And that's what I was saying earlier. There's a lot that we could look at now that we couldn't before. But the next step was that some people have looked at livestock in the U.S. So livestock in the U.S. up until 1996 were fed corn and soybean. I mean, that's what most of it does, is feed cattle and chickens and all of that. And after 1996, they introduced genetically engineered crops. And the question was, well, did that affect the health of those livestock? And we were especially interested in pigs, because pigs are physiologically closer to humans than others.
Sure.
But looking at all the data from there, there was no decline in the efficiency that these livestock converted that feed into meat. And if you think about Purdue chickens or anybody like a group like that, they make their profit off having the best quality thing for their livestock. So they wouldn't buy that stuff if it knocked off efficiency of conversion of the feed to the, even by 0.5%. That's huge amounts of money. So we looked at the data, and it showed no effects. People would say, of course, they don't keep their livestock till they're old, right? So we couldn't follow that with those. Sometimes dairy cattle, you know, get a little old, but mostly those pigs and chickens don't have a long life.
Indeed.
So that's a criticism of those things. So what I'm showing you here is, of course, everything has its has information, but also there are limits.
Sure.
So the final thing we did, which hadn't been done before, but we had 20 years since these crops were introduced, there have been people who have said that cancer rates have gone up dramatically, or autism has gone up, and that's because of people eating genetically engineered crops. And we thought, look, we have to look at the data on these autism rates, on diabetes rates, on cancer rates. And so fortunately, we went into the literature, and especially for the U.S. and cancer rates, all different kinds of cancers, there are data on that. And we're interested in incidence, not mortality, because, you know, if you're treated well, that can go down. But incidence should reflect, you know, the environment and everything else. So we looked at whether the incidence had changed since 1996, whether there was a change in the pattern. And we could find no change. But more so, we compared the U.S. and Canada, where people eat genetically engineered crops, to the U.K. and the E.U., where people haven't eaten them, to ask, are the patterns any different in the U.S. and Canada, because, you know, compared to that? So it was sort of a natural experiment, and we saw nothing.
Okay.
So what we conclude, which isn't exactly the New York Times headline, is that if we look at all four of these sources of evidence, we see no evidence that there has been any impact, negative impact on health by these genetically engineered crops. But we also put in the caveat because, you know, we don't know that they couldn't be 20 years. Maybe that's not long enough. Maybe in 40 years you'll see it.
Sure.
But this is the problem with all kinds of health claims. I mean, you see how we've changed in terms of, are eggs good for you or bad for you, right?
Right.
I mean, it's so hard when the change is an epidemiological kind of thing where it's a very small impact. You know, you can have biochemical markers. What is it? What does it mean? How much salt is good for you? You know, there's so many things where it's very hard to get that data, and it's also hard with genetically engineered crops. So for us to make a blanket statement and say that they're safe, there is no problem. But what we can say is that they seem to be as safe as conventionally bred crops. It could be that they're actually better for you health-wise. I mean, there is at least one thing, is that in the corn, there's a lower incidence of a certain fungus that produces a certain toxin. So it could be that it's a little bit better, but there's no evidence that it's better, right?
Right.
So there's no evidence it's better, no evidence that it's worse. But people have to make up their minds, and this gets to the labeling issues and all of those things
which
as well.
We're about to get to.
Oh, okay.
Well, Fred, don't take this the wrong way. But given the lack of a definitive answer that people seem to be looking for, you know, with that in mind, what was the ultimate value of this report?
Yeah. Well, I guess, you know, our issue is about, you can give people a definitive answer that would potentially lack credibility, or you can give them the whole meal, you know, and let them digest it a little bit. I think that people are smart. In general, they care about them, you know, their health and all of those things. Let them look at that. Let them consider what they want to purchase in the supermarket. We gave them all the evidence we have. Four different kinds of approaches. We see no impact on health. And remember, there's going to be less pesticide residues in some of these things. So that's what we say. But to assure anybody beyond the 20 years that we know all the answers, I think that's why should we, you know, why would we want to go beyond the data?
Sure, that would assail the credibility coming out. And you have rightly identified the issues of trust as being crucial to this.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things, it's interesting because, of course, the industry, you know, that's doing the genetic engineering points to our report as saying that. But there are things in our report that they didn't find very palatable either. So I think that you have to, you know, we weren't just, you know, sort of waving one flag.
Right.
You know, everybody always says, you know, if you write a report and everybody finds something wrong with it, then you must have done a good job. I hope that's true.
Indeed. Well, Fred, one of the core messages in the report was that the new technologies, as you've already alluded to, are blurring the line between conventional and GMO. How is that occurring? Tell us a little bit more about that, and where is the debate going in that context?
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting, you know, from the perspective of somebody at NC State, you know, watching all the things developing, you know, people are moving beyond these traditional approaches. There's something that has been in the news for a while, for the last 2 years, called the CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing approaches.
Right, which we've featured on this show several
times. Oh, wonderful.
Times
because in terms of genetic engineering, the regulatory agencies are scratching their heads and trying to figure out, is this genetic engineering or not? In terms of a researcher looking at it and asking, are you engineering the plant? Yes, you're engineering the plant. That's why you're editing it, you know, to engineer it to do something you want.
Right.
So it's, but it's not necessarily transgenic. So maybe I should make that distinction. When the 1996, the plants came out, they were all transgenic. And what that means is that genes from one organism were put into another organism. And typically that meant taking genes from a bacteria and putting them into a plant, or actually synthesizing a gene and putting it into a plant. With the CRISPR-Cas9, a lot of the changes are called cisgenic, meaning they just change genes that are in the plant itself, sometimes just changing a tiny nucleotide base pair. And so some people say, ah, that's so tiny, it can't be important. But as we went through all of our research, you know, it became clear that how big the change is in terms of how many base pairs of DNA you change is not correlated with how big a characteristic change there could be. So you could change, knock out one gene just by altering a few base pairs, change a whole metabolic process, and wind up with a change in the profile of secondary plant compounds, things that give them aroma, things that also could or could not be allergenic or anything like that, could change. So this is where we, you know, sort of wound up, despite ourselves in a sense, to say, look, it's the characteristics of the plant. Because, you know, some people would say, oh, well, let's look at how big the genetic change is, because that seems like, you know, it appeals to everybody, right? Oh, right. It's just a tiny change, not a big change.
But, that's not the important question.
But it's not, yeah. So that's sort of a piece. Am I getting it where you wanted to
yes,
go?
Yes, okay. Absolutely. I was going to just alert our listeners, if they're interested in those issues. Several weeks ago, we had your NC State colleague, Rodolphe Barangu,
who is
working on CRISPR-Cas9 in this very area.
Yeah.
And it's some fascinating stuff.
Well, Rodolphe was one of the, in some ways, unsung heroes of all of this. I mean, he really moved that thing forward in ways. It's a very impressive effort he has made.
Indeed. Well, Fred, before we move on to some other things I wanted to ask you about, let's go back to this labeling issue, because that is very much in the news right now, even. You know, your group was given credit for not shrinking from the controversy about labeling of GMO food. What was the committee's position on that burning issue?
Yeah, okay. Well, there are actually, you could look at it, there are two aspects of it. One is, should FDA, the Food and Drug Agency, be labeling foods that are genetically engineered? And we looked into the regulations. We went back and forth with FDA, with other people. Our legal experts were involved in this. And indeed, the dominion of FDA in terms of labeling, they can't label something if it does not have some information that would be helpful to people in terms of health.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you can label things in terms of how much salt they have or other things, so people can judge, you know, whether they're getting too much, too little, and such.
Sure.
But given what we found about the conventionally bred, the genetically engineered crops that are now on the market, the ones that are on the market, we found no health effects. So FDA doesn't really have the purview to label those. And this went back and forth a little bit, but they could show you that. And then we asked FDA, but wait, this labeling of artificial flavors versus natural flavors, I mean, does that mean that artificial flavors are bad for you? And the answer is no, but it wasn't FDA that decided to label those things. It was Congress.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Congress does have the right to ask for labeling. We have labeling on things in terms of country of origin.
Sure.
Right? So, but that's not an FDA kind of thing. So, you know, basically we said, lay off the FDA. They can't do this. But then it comes to the Vermont kind of things. And what we said was, look, if people want the right to know, for whatever that reason is, the Congress or state legislature or however you do it, they have the right to do that. But we wanted to sort of say clearly to people that you should think twice about labeling it what you're really concerned about is our health issues.
Right. Well, and it looks like as of right now, the bill that has just passed Congress and I guess is awaiting the president's signature at this point, nullifies the Vermont labeling law and institutes a system of QR coding so that you can take your smartphone and get the information, but it's not right there on the label, which seems like, a reasonable compromise, except for the fact that a lot of people don't have smartphones and have no idea what a QR code is.
Right. So my son-in-law just gave me a smartphone. You know, I would have been one of those people lost in the supermarket. So this is, of course, came out after the report, and we haven't, you know, I haven't really gone through the nuance of it. But indeed, FDA and some other groups are a little concerned about, again, what would you call a genetically engineered product?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how are you going to label something as genetically engineered or not? And there's, I think, some language in that legislation about what would be called genetically engineered and what would not be called genetically engineered.
Okay.
I want to bring this back to the issue. One thing that we found was, well, why would you label something genetically engineered? Let's say it's transgenic, so it's herbicide tolerant, right? So you can spray herbicides on it. And that's one of those things that would raise some concern that, wow, you may have something in the product that are either proteins from the genetically engineered proteins or DNA. But some of the products, like sugar beets, are processed to make sugar. Well, we look through these reports. I mean, if you have sugar that's been refined, that's part of the refining process, getting rid of any protein, getting rid of the DNA. It's really hard to find that in the product. Mm-hmm. So, it's sugar. So, but it came from genetically engineered sugar beet. In the same way that if a watermelon came from Mexico, it's a watermelon. But if people want to know if it came from Mexico, if people want to know if it came from genetically engineered, we had sort of said, you know, but make the decision consciously, you know, why right. you want to know.
Well, you know, this certainly brings up the fact that, as the report notes, policy regarding GE crops has scientific, legal, and social dimensions, and not all issues can be answered by science alone.
Yeah, well, that was our our feeling.
Indeed.
You know, I think we sort of wrote that kind of thing. That was our sense, and I think everybody knows that. You know, one of the things that you hear a lot is, oh, we need science-based regulation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a nice idea, but actually when you look at how we regulate everything, you know, I mean, not everything, but most things that matter to people, there's a social aspect of what, how much regulation there is, right?
Sure.
You know, it's not just, and this is where you go back to this 1996 report on risk assessment in a democratic society. It's a democratic society. You're doing this based on people's concerns. And you understand, of course, people can know that there's a risk to cigarettes, but they rather have that than, you know, they make their own choice. And when something, though, is imposed upon them and they can't make the choice, then their concern changes, right? So these are, you know, one of the things with genetically engineered crops early on was, I can't tell if this tomato is engineered or not. Whereas if you gave me a plum or a plumule or whatever, these different kinds of things, at least I could tell, so I could decide for myself.
Mm-hmm.
So these are all aspects that go into this kind of assessment.
And one of the major places where these aspects are considered on an ongoing basis is the center that you co-direct at NC State called the Genetic Engineering and Society Center. Tell us a little bit more about the center and what it's all about. Was I correct in characterizing it as a think tank?
I guess that would be a term. We never have used that term, but you know, but that's
feel
I mean,
free
basically.
To start.
But you know, I say, you know, our approach is to bring together researchers and scholars at NC State coming from a variety of disciplines to address issues about genetic engineering, and not just genetic engineering of crops. That's just one piece of this. As things are moving forward, the products and everything and the processes are very different. But we have people involved in our center who are in the humanities, in social sciences, and in biology, molecular biology, mathematics, economics, to all come together to look at it. So it's a very diverse group of people, and our students are just as diverse.
Mm-hmm.
So we, one of the foci, because of a grant we got from the National Science Foundation, is looking at genetically engineered pests. So very different from genetically engineered crops, looking at mosquitoes that are engineered not to transmit dengue fever or malaria.
Sure.
And this sometimes is now in the news because this is going on with the Zika virus, right?
Right.
You know, we deal with things of what happens if the public wants it, but the researchers don't think it's safe.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's a little flip sides here.
That's a sticky wicket.
Yeah. So, you know, because there's a real issue, you know, people want to answer that, you know, Zika is really scary.
Yeah.
So, you know, where do people stand on that? How does that go forward? So those are the kinds of issues that our center addresses. But it goes beyond that to think about things, you know, almost all the insulin that's used, right, for diabetes is genetically engineered. You know, that is that okay? Is that fine? But what about when we start genetically engineering animals? So the salmon that's been genetically engineered, somebody just came up with an approach to engineer cattle so they wouldn't have horns. Well, what that means is that they don't have to wrestle them down and cut off their horns.
Right.
So in some ways, it's more humane. What does that lead us to? And what about glowfish? We have glowfish in our offices just to show people. These are genetically engineered fish that have fluorescent protein in them, right?
Sure.
It's just done for our amusement, all right? Is that any different, of course, than a lot of dogs and cats that have been bred for our enjoyment?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so those are questions we deal with. And then finally, the question of genetically engineering human beings. And there was just a Pew Initiative study that just came out on people's views of enhancement using genetic engineering,
mm-hmm.
and how that connects to people's religious beliefs. You know, so these are the kinds of things that our center has been dealing with.
Well, it's wonderful that you are delving into these really very important issues and important conversations.
Yeah. And I just would say that, you know, of course, we're not the only institution in the triangle that's interested in Duke has a science and society group. And,
sure.
You know, we hope that there'll be good interactions in all of these things. Yeah.
You are listening to Radio In Vivo, and my guest today is Dr. Fred Gould from NC State University, who, among other things, is an expert on genetically modified crops. Well, Fred, I wanted to be sure to spend some of our time together discussing another new technology in genetic engineering that perhaps hasn't received quite as much attention yet, but you started to touch on a minute ago, and is surely going to be receiving a lot of attention in the near future. And that is this technology known as gene drives. To begin that part of our discussion, what exactly are gene drives and how do they work?
Yeah, well, that's, again, good question. That's a lot. Like, we could go on and on for hours about that, but I would start saying that this is, people have been interested in changing natural populations, especially of pests, to cause them to crash, to suppress them mm-hmm. for many years. Since the 1940s, people have been using things. We've eliminated the screwworm fly using a genetic methodology to sterilize them and so on, and that's been very successful. But the tools have been very rough, and they don't work for most species. So now, and this is where this CRISPR comes in, mm-hmm. is there is a way of the whole idea of the CRISPR-Cas9 is that it inserts itself, can insert a gene into a specific location. Well, what people have figured out is that you could actually insert the genes for making the Cas9 protein and the RNA guides, and they would insert themselves. Well, if they insert themselves, then they perpetuate themselves.
Right.
So every time an individual insect, for example, and I work with mosquitoes, so I'll talk about those. When it mates with a wild-type mosquito, it becomes a heterozygote, and it converts to a homozygote because this CRISPR-Cas9 reinserts itself in the other copy. Mm-hmm. So what that's doing is, instead of inheritance like Mendel used to describe it, right, this 50-50 kind of reassortment, you can wind up with 95% of the offspring having the trait. Instead of 50%.
Sure.
Now, what that means is it'll push itself into a population, or as they say, drive itself into a population. Now, there are two types that are being considered with mosquitoes. One type actually has associated with the gene that drives itself a gene that makes it not be able to vector to the disease. So you wind up with a mosquito that's a nuisance but isn't causing disease transmission. The other approach is to put a gene in that will inhibit female reproduction. And what that does is produces lots of males, and the males carry that gene, and it keeps pushing into the population. And what that causes is suppression of the population.
Sure.
And there's a lot of research being done on that, especially the Gates Foundation. Ah, God, I wouldn't doubt that they've put close to $100 million into that work. And there are some incredible researchers working on that right now, and they're doing some testing in Africa. But of course, this brings up an issue of what's called transboundary movement. Once you put that out there, older people understand what Ice-9 was with Kurt Vonnegut. You know, like right. Once it gets going, you can't put it back in the hat.
Right. Sure.
So there are a lot of issues with that. So basically, is a possibility that you could eradicate the malaria transmitting mosquitoes. And of course,
I remember hearing you present about that at least 10 years ago.
Yeah, well, we've been interested in it for a long time, but the technology has just flourished lately. Now, I want to say, even though it has flourished, it's not there yet.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, sometimes people, again, as I said, people might want it, but the researchers aren't ready. You know, so you don't want to release something that's halfway there, and then you could have a disaster, right? So I think there have been a lot of researchers who are critical of this in terms of, let's wait. But when you go to the philanthropists, you know, they see, like, wait a minute. Millions of people might die because you're trying to be careful.
Right.
You know, I mean, are you killing babies because you're denying? You know, like, so it's a very interesting change in terms of where this technology is.
Yeah, but exactly the opposite of the GMO debate.
Yeah. So I'm pretty optimistic, you know, watching the research and how it's moving, that something is going to come on the horizon, and not just for mosquitoes, probably for agricultural pests, but the very interesting twist that we're very interested in is for conservation biology. So you may know that there are rats and mice are invasive on oceanic islands, and they wipe out on the Galapagos Island. They kill a lot of endangered species. So people have been trying to eradicate those by dropping rat poison. And they've been successful in some places, but it's hard to do. So the people who do that have come to us looking for approaches to basically use this gene drive just on an island to eradicate the rats or mice, and they're making progress there, but you want to limit it to that island. You don't want them to get off that island.
Right.
So there's a lot of social issues with that. There's also on Hawaii, there are the Hawaiian honey creepers that are actually more beautiful than the Galapagos finches. But they're threatened because of bird malaria. A lot of other things, not just bird malaria, but mm-hmm. bird malaria wasn't on the island because there were no mosquitoes years ago. And now it's there, and the birds haven't experienced it, so they're not resistant to it as the birds on the mainland are. And the invasive birds come in and they outcompete them. So the goal is to get that mosquito that transmits bird malaria and make it not be able to transmit bird malaria.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a whole different view. And some conservation biologists are right on board because they have nothing else. And others say, look, we're playing God. Too much messing around.
Right.
So interesting right. stuff to come.
Absolutely. Well, back in June, the NAS released a report about gene drive technology. And I know you weren't on that committee, but I'm sure you were involved with that effort. Tell us a little bit about that report and some of the issues that it dealt with.
Well, I just say, you know, our Genetic Engineering Society Center has grown. And one of our members in the center, Jason Delborn, was on that committee.
Mm-hmm.
And we're having a meeting put on by the Organization of Cooperation and Economic Development, OECD, to look at potential for governance, you know, worldwide governance of this technology because of the movement of it.
Right.
But also Jennifer Kuzma, who's the other co-director of the Genetic Engineering Society Center, has done another National Academy report. National Academy is pretty active
there. They've
been asked by the regulatory agents to really relook at what's going to happen, not just in terms of new crops that are being developed, but other things that are coming around. New things called synthetic biology, where you're making new organisms. And she's really a leader in that area. So we have a lot going on. But to go back to your question.
We'll need to get her on this show.
Yes, I think you really should. I think you really should. And Jason would be great, too, because he comes from a completely different perspective. He's a STS scholar, Science, Technology, and Society.
Okay.
And they look at, you know, like what is the background and what is the motivation of the researchers? How do they determine what is responsible innovation? You know, and Jennifer's been involved in that as well. So we have a number of people that I hope you'll tap for your show. But anyway, to get back to the gene drive study, I think they did a great job of looking at these things and looking towards the future. And basically, you know, again, it's one of these things where does the headline really show what's happening? I think in the beginning, I think the New York Times had a headline saying group gives green light to gene drive. And then I think it sort of changed to yellow light. You know, I mean, you know, basically they said, you know, we're not ready to do these releases yet. We need to do more studies, and we're not technically ready. So they called for more lab studies and actually for more work in terms of bringing in the public to understand this technology and to, you know, not just instead of getting ahead with the technology, letting the governance catch up to it and getting that set up.
Well, speaking of the governments, I wanted to ask you about what is the regulatory framework right now? Who is watching all this?
Right. Well, I think all the regulatory agencies are watching it very carefully, but nobody has stepped out to do anything with it. So I would say that in terms of genetically engineered mosquitoes, there is a genetically engineered mosquito being released in Brazil an experimental way, but you know, people would love to use it for Zika. But that's not something with gene drive, something you'd have to keep putting out. But nobody has really touched that. So I would say that the Gates Foundation is pretty much ahead because they really want to do this in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm actually on their ethics committee. They, you know, we talk about credibility. They decided that, you know this is controversial, but they also see how beneficial it could be. So they got a group of people together who are separate from their own research group to as sort of overseeing what's going on. I mean, we're not, you know, we can't tell them what to do. We can give them advice. But I think they see that as important of having an independent group looking at what they're doing, not only what they're doing in terms of genetically engineering it, but in terms of how they're interacting with the public in Africa, how they're interacting with policymakers. I think one of the things in that National Academy report was, you know, like, how do you reach out to the public? It's not easy, right?
Sure.
Do you have focus groups? Do you have surveys? How do you make sure the public understands what's going on? Who are the stakeholders? Mm-hmm. You know, who do you listen to? And one of the things that comes out in the Gates Foundation kinds of things was thinking about it. Well, there's certainly going to be some people who are always going to be opposed to it. How do you sort of give justice to listening to people, and then how do you make decisions? You know, you can't always come, what is consensus? You know, how do you do those things? So there's some very tough questions, and that's, again, where this Genetic Engineering Society Center comes in, is to really try to deal with these things. It's not going to be a simple answer.
Absolutely, and it'll be just fascinating to watch these issues going forward and see if, for example, Gene Drive actually gets out into the world and starts making a huge difference. Well, Fred, it's been a great pleasure to welcome you today on Radio In Vivo. We will be continuing to watch the rapidly evolving and exciting world of genetically engineered crops as the global need for advanced agriculture continues to grow. Best of luck for continued success, and thanks for joining me on the show today.
Great. Thank you for having me.
We've got some great guests lined up in the coming weeks here on Radio In Vivo. You can check the website, radioinvivo.net, or our Facebook site for the lineup of upcoming shows. Join us again next time for Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM-FM Carrboro and Chapel Hill. If you enjoy the program, we ask that you please make an effort to support the station by volunteering, contributing, or underwriting our programming. One great way to do that is to log on to the WCOM website, wcomfm.org. Click on the Donate Now button and get the details on how to make a small monthly contribution or a large monthly contribution via a secure donation on PayPal to help keep this independent voice of the community on the air. Now be sure to stay tuned for one of our most popular shows on the WCOM schedule, The Courage Cocktail with Leanne McClymont. We appreciate you listening, and we will catch you next time.